This is VOA News. I'm Liz Pelka. U.S. Attorney General William Barr could release his first summary of Robert Mueller's probe into Russian election meddling as early as Sunday. The report also investigated whether President Donald Trump sought to obstruct the investigation. Key lawmakers, opposition Democrats, and some of Trump's Republican allies have all called for release of the full report, but it is not clear whether Barr will do so. Republican Congressman Jim Jordan said on ABC's This Week, Barr will release what he can from the report.
He said he's going to consult with Rod Rosenstein. He's going to consult with the special counsel, Bob Mueller, and he's going to release as much as he possibly can, consistent with the law. I think the Democrats should be that should be what we all want.
Also speaking on ABC's This Week, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff says he thinks the White House will fight to keep much of the Mueller report private, but the House will battle to have a look.
We are going to take it as far as necessary to make sure that we do. We have an independent obligation to share the facts with the American people. We in the Intelligence Committee have a particular obligation to determine whether there is evidence that the president may be compromised in any way, whether that is criminal or not.
White House aides say Trump has not been briefed on the outcome of Mueller's investigation. The U.S. leader has dozens of times derided Mueller's investigation as unwarranted and a witch hunt, while rejecting accusations that he colluded with Russia or that he tried to thwart the probe. The United Nations says the combined death toll in southern African nations affected by Cyclone Idai has exceeded 700. More than 400 of the deaths have occurred in Mozambique, where aid groups are struggling to assist tens of thousands of people on the ground. We have more on this story on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Rescue helicopters airlifted 479 people from a disabled cruise ship off Norway's western coast. The ship regained engine power Sunday afternoon and was escorted by three vessels to the nearby port of Molde. 20 people were injured in the ordeal as the Viking Sky ship tossed in winds and rough seas. Passenger Alexis Shepard of California says she boats all the time and has never experienced anything as close to this.
I'm a yachtswoman. I've spent a lot of time on yachts, and this was unlike anything that I've ever experienced before. So, yes, it was absolutely horrible.
The Viking Sky crew issued a mayday call Saturday as the engines failed with the ship within 100 meters of striking underwater rocks. British Chancellor Philip Hammond warned on Sunday if Prime Minister Theresa May were to be ousted as leader, it would hinder efforts in leaving the European Union with a deal. He said this is not the time to change leadership in response to rumors that Conservatives are urging May to step down.
To be talking about changing the players on the board, frankly, is self-indulgent at this time. We have to decide how we want to proceed.
Some Conservative leaders want May to recognize her weakened political position and leave the Prime Minister's post. However, there are no indications from Downing Street she will. May last week asked the leaders of the 27 remaining EU nations for a postponement, in which they agreed to extend Brexit until at least April 12th. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump this week in Washington. The meeting comes as Netanyahu's Likud party is lagging in opinion polls ahead of elections next month. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Netanyahu is facing a series of corruption allegations, and the latest opinion polls show the new blue and white party headed by Gantz edging past Netanyahu's Likud. The Israeli Prime Minister has stressed his close relationship with Trump, and he lauded close U.S.-Israeli ties in a meeting with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo last week.
Our alliance in recent years has never been stronger. It's an unbreakable bond.
Netanyahu also thanked the United States for walking away from what he called the disastrous Iran nuclear deal. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Trump recently announced a change in American policy on the Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in 1967 and later annexed. Trump tweeted last week that the United States recognizes Israeli sovereignty over that territory. More stories on VOAnews.com. I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotting in Washington.
The Constitution itself says that the citizens can question the mental faculty of the president. And therefore, if somebody is questioning his mental capacity, it cannot be an offense. It is a right for citizens to question him.
Zambian opposition demands the immediate release of opposition leader Sean Tembo.
We have not only evidences in voices, we have in video, in pictures of where even that of image where these alarms are intimidated and forced, you know, by thugs. And we saw, you know, in clear pictures and videos how, you know, thugs virtually took over the electoral process, you know, chasing people from the polling units.
Local poll observer groups say allegations of vote buying and violence undermine Nigerian elections.
Killing people unlawfully just serves to make their ultimate goal of protecting the country from abusive Islamist groups far more complicated, because it means that it's going to push people over into the hands of the Islamists.
And Human Rights Watch expresses concern over abuses by Burkinabe Islamists and state security forces. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, is demanding the immediate and unconditional release of Sean Tembo, leader of the Patriots for Economic Progress Party. The opposition leader was arrested Saturday after calling for an examination of President Edgar Lungu's mental state. His call came after local media reported that the government purchased a new $50 million presidential Gulfstream jet. For more on the call for the release of the opposition leader, I reach out to Kakoma, spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition party, the UPND.
We are demanding for the immediate release of the PEP president, Sean Tembo, who was arrested yesterday on a trumped-up charge of defamation of the president. The ruling party, the Patriotic Front, are using an archaic piece of legislation, a colonial piece of legislation, to try to silence the opposition. There is nothing that is contained in a statement that the PEP president, Sean Tembo, issued that is even near anything called defamation. All what he did was to question the rationale of the president to buy himself a state-of-the-art jet for more than $50 million when he's failing to buy medicines for hospitals and failing to buy basic things that are needed in the education sector. And for the first time in the history of Zambia, failing to pay salaries for civil servants on time. And he was saying that his behavior is abnormal.
But Charles, he broke the law, as the police have been saying. He broke the law and he has to face the consequences, because the Constitution says you just cannot defame the president.
The Constitution itself says that the citizens can question the mental faculty of the president. And therefore, if somebody is questioning his mental capacity, it cannot be an offense. It is a right for citizens to question him if his behavior appears to be abnormal. And that is why we think that it is just a victimization of the opposition leader. It is meant to instill fear in the opposition so that they don't criticize the government, so that they don't criticize the president. But it is our right to provide checks and balances and to criticize the government and to criticize the president whenever we think that he's wrong.
But supporters, but the supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front Party are saying the Gulfstream jet is for the state of Zambia and not particularly for the president.
Well, we're questioning because this is extravagance at its worst. This country is in a crisis now, and we don't have the money of the country to spend on luxury items like a state-of-the-art presidential jet. We already have a jet for the president. They have not reported any fault with that presidential jet. So why go for another jet? In any case, this country is in a debt crisis. were overborrowed. And to go for a loan from the Russians or from the Chinese in order to buy a presidential jet is extravagant at its worst. It was not necessary. And if they wanted to get a loan, they should have gotten a loan to invest in productive sector that can create employment and not for luxury purposes.
But isn't the president's security paramount or important? Because that's one of the reasons why the jet was acquired, because the old one you spoke about could imperil the life of the president. Now we also understand the president, the opposition leader, has gone on hunger strike in detention. After breaking the law, he wants to put additional pressure on the administration to release him. Some are saying this is yet another indication of him trying to play political games after playing, you know, a political game that led him to detention so far. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's totally no justification for the president to buy himself a presidential jet at a time when he's failing to pay his salary for civil servants and failing to fund the food reserve agency, which is a government agency, to buy a maize from farmers. So we think that his priorities are wrong, and he's sending this country in further crisis in terms of the national debt. The debt has become unsustainable, and they were just coming from a situation recently when our debts were forgiven under the highly indebted country's initiative, HIPIC. But now he's sliding back into that debt trap. So we think that he's wrong to go on a borrowing spree and for luxury purposes, because that jet will have no capacity to pay for itself. They're just going to tax the Zambian people more so that we pay for the loan for the presidential jet. I think it's wrong. There's no security threat that is being posed to the president, because the president has already an existing presidential jet. And in many cases, he also uses other planes that are owned by the Zambian Air Force. And therefore, there's no threat to his security.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition party, the UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A Nigerian civil society group has expressed concern about violence and voter irregularities in the supplementary elections held Saturday. Women Arise for Change Initiative, which monitored the elections, said there were instances where thugs carried out violence and in some cases intimidation to suppress voter turnout. It came as local media reports say the polls were tainted by voter apathy, vote buying, and allegations of manipulation. For more regarding the group's poll observation, I reach Olufemi Akindele Lawson, Senior Program Officer for Women Arise for Change, a local polling organization which monitors the supplementary elections across Nigeria.
What we observe in places where our organization observed this election in Benue State, Plateau State, Sokoto State, Kano State, and Bauchi State, and some constituencies in Lagos and Bayelsa State, what we observe is that generally, UNEC has been able to sustain its capacity in the deployment of its personnel and logistics. But unfortunately, we have continued to experience what we saw during the presidential election, which became more worrisome during the governorship and last state house assembly election, that elections that were held. What we observed, particularly from field reports from observers who were in Kano, was a clear-cut case of conspiracy between the security agencies, particularly the police, thugs who are sponsored by the state. It is unfortunate that people who ordinarily were expected to exercise their franchise were intimidated, observers were chased away, media were denied access to cover these elections across the local government in Kano. The press and observers were intimidated. I will find a situation whereby aliens who were not registered in certain constituencies were imported into these constituencies to vote.
What about the performance of officials of INEC in the supplementary elections?
INEC alone cannot deliver credible elections as long as we have a system where other stakeholders within the electoral chain. The electoral chain in Nigeria here consists of the INEC, the security, which plays a crucial role, then the observers, the media, and the political party. But INEC performed its duty by ensuring that as early as 8 a.m., INEC has been able to deploy its materials and personnel into most polling units where these elections are to be held. In actual fact, as at 10 o'clock yesterday, we recorded about 95% deployment of personnel and material. But this were not enough to give us a credible process, because when INEC deploys its material, it requires coverage from the security agencies to protect its officials, to protect this material. And that's where our elections become flawed, when security and other stakeholders are not playing their role. I want to personally commend INEC for making sure that it deploys its personnel and logistics as and when due. But other stakeholders, including the government, are not doing enough to make sure that INEC work is totally successful.
So how can this problem of voter intimidation and harassment and the collusion you spoke about to undermine the integrity of the election be resolved once and for all?
This is a major issue of concern to us as Nigerians. We had expected that after 2015, our elections would have improved. But 2019 is going to go down in history as one of the worst elections we have had in the history of this country. By the time INEC in 2011 to 2015 introduced the electronic accreditation system, that the use of permanent voter card and electronic card reader, we thought we were going to advance from the ages where voting can be easily manipulated and people are denied access to voting. But what we saw in 2019, there has been no improvement. And in ensuring that we prevent this in future, we need to begin to advocate for a more sophisticated approach to our elections. We need to advance to more electronic system of voting, where we may not necessarily have to go and put our people on queues at the mercy of political thugs and their conspiracies within the security agencies. We need to advance to a situation whereby Nigerians can vote from the comfort of their zones, their communities, their areas, without necessarily gathering at polling stations where they're subjected to harassment, inducement, intimidation, and all sort of things that have made this electoral process very questionable.
All observers like yours have been accusing the government of colluding with thugs to intimidate and harass opponents to prevent supporters of their opponents from going to the polls, particularly in this instance of supplementary elections organized by INEC on Saturday. They asked for proof of that.
Well, unfortunately for them, they have forgotten that we are living in a digital age. In actual fact, most of the events of yesterday were captured, they were live streamed. So these are not, you know, issues of the past where you can easily, you know, dispute claims that we make as observers. In actual fact, we have not only evidences in voices, we have in video, in pictures of where even staff of INEC were being harassed and intimidated and forced, you know, by thugs. And we saw, you know, in clear pictures and videos how, you know, thugs virtually took over the electoral process, you know, chasing people from the polling units armed with dangerous weapons such as cudgels, machetes, guns in some places. So they can continue to live in denial, but that will not prevent us from saying what we have seen as observers, and that will not prevent us from exposing where they are flawed as Nigerians. We owe it a duty to tell the story as it is, and that is the only way our democracy can be advanced.
Olufemi Akindele Lawson is a senior program officer for Women Arise for Change, a local polling organization. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. A U.S.-based international human rights group has expressed concern that the Burkina Faso State Security Forces and armed Islamists committed atrocities against unarmed civilians. In a newly released report, Human Rights Watch said the atrocities left scores dead, created fear, and displaced tens of thousands from their homes. It also says it plans to engage with the administration in Ouagadougou to ensure the state security forces respect and protect the rights of citizens in their counter-terrorism operations. For more regarding the report, I reach Corinne Dufka, a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C.
We're extremely concerned about a dramatic increase in atrocities committed both by the jihadists who, since 2016, have been active in Burkina Faso, but also by the security forces in the context of counterterrorism operations. The jihadists have been increasing their presence in the north, in the Sahel region of Burkina Faso, where this report concentrates its work, and we documented 42 executions by them. On the other hand, we also documented 116 killings by the security forces in response to the increasing activity by the jihadists.
Well, Human Rights Watch engaged the government to address this particular human rights concern?
Yes, absolutely. We shared our findings with the government during the research phase, as well as in a letter to the government prior to the publication of the report. They committed to investigate these alleged atrocities, which we're encouraged by. But we're a little concerned because last year we also raised the same concerns. They did indeed do a few credible investigations, but the abuses have persisted. We insist on the adherence to national and international laws, for principled reasons, because it is wrong to kill people in the course of counterterrorism operations like this unlawfully, but also for practical reasons, because their excesses are only serving to push people into the hands of the armed Islamist group.
When they conducted the investigation, were some of these perpetrators brought to book, and do you anticipate that if they investigate this round, the masterminds will be dealt with according to the Burkinabe law?
Well, the investigations that they conducted last year are ongoing, but they have been meaningful investigations, and we will take them at their commitment, and we will encourage them, and we will be following those investigations. But again, the failure to investigate those involved, and again, these were not individual bad apples. These were the abuses that we documented by the security forces were committed within the context of large operations in which often dozens of motorcycles and numerous vehicles and also small drones were used. They surrounded marketplaces and then picked up and later executed up to 14 men, largely Pullmen. So this suggests that there is a level of organization that's very worrying. The vast majority of incidents we documented were allegedly perpetrated by a particular group of gendarmes. So again, we're urging them to adopt a counterterrorism strategy that is grounded in respect for human rights and lawful behavior.
Well, some Burkinabes that I spoke with are saying that these security operatives are just acting to protect life and property as mandated by the Burkinabe Constitution, and it's unfortunate that those who died as a result of that, but they still have to continue doing their work. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, there has been a very worrying increase in activity by the armed Islamist groups and abuses by these groups. They have increased their presence not only in northern Burkina Faso, but in numerous other regions, including the east, in areas that border Benin. And Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana. So they're very concerned about that. And also remember, Burkina Bay continue to be in some ways traumatized by the horrific terrorist attacks which hit Ouagadougou a few years ago. So there is, an esprit, I think, to support the armed forces in doing their work. And of course, they have a very important job to do, that of protecting the population against abuses by these armed groups. But their operations must be lawful because, again, killing people unlawfully just serves to make their ultimate goal of protecting the country from abusive Islamist groups far more complicated, because it means that it's going to push people over into the hands of the Islamists, which is why we urge them, they have a job to do, but they also, they have national laws and they signed international conventions which oblige them to conduct those operations in a lawful manner.
Corinne Dufka is a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C. The UN Children's Fund reports nearly half of the 1.7 million people affected by Cyclone Idaia in southern Africa are children. The official number of deaths across the region has now risen to over 700, but this figure is expected to increase once the waters have receded and the bodies of those who have drowned and gone missing are found. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Conditions in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe remain critical. Thousands of people are still trapped by the floodwaters, many huddled on rooftops and in trees waiting to be rescued. The UN Children's Fund reports the situation for hundreds of thousands of children caught up in this monumental storm is particularly dire. It says many do not have adequate shelter and are in urgent need of food and safe drinking water. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyerak says children are particularly susceptible to infectious diseases.
Without safe and effective water sanitation and hygiene services, children are at high risk of preventable disease, including diarrhea, typhoid, and cholera, and also increasingly vulnerable to malnutrition.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies reports cases of cholera have been confirmed in the city of Beira in Mozambique, the epicenter of the cyclone. It warns the risk of outbreaks of malaria, waterborne, and infectious diseases is high due to the prevailing conditions. UNICEF reports many schools and hospitals have been destroyed or damaged or are being used as collective shelters. As a consequence, thousands of children are unable to go to school. It says it is crucial for children to go back to the classroom as soon as possible. Officials explain many children are suffering from physical and emotional distress. They say school provides them with a structure and a sense of normalcy that can help them better deal with their anguish in this time of extreme chaos. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, victims of Cyclone Idaia say the Zimbabwean government needs to expedite relief aid, as Colombo's Mavunga reports from the hard city of Chimanimani. The government says it is appealing to the international community for help with medicine, food, and infrastructure.
The Mungana family is using bare hands to move stones from their former bedroom. They are looking for the body of their 17-year-old nephew who disappeared when Cyclone Idai hit Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Mozambique. Their 66-year-old father was found dead here 5 days ago. Beta Mungana says he wants President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government to assist them. Since Cyclone Idai, we are struggling to have food. Our clothes were washed away, so we are wondering what to do. The government promised to assist us with shelter, but it seems that help will come even to those who never lost anything, says Mungana. I lost my father. We are still looking for my cousin. It is painful. We have no shelter and no food. The body was found and buried late Friday, but food and shelter problem remains. It is the same for the Dube Magoso family about 500 meters away. Their 83-year-old father was suffocated when their house collapsed during the cyclone. The mother escaped with several injuries. Their son, Musabengana Dube Magoso, says they want the Zimbabwean government to chip in. He says the government must look for a better place to resettle us so that we can get some income to ensure the remaining get some source of livelihood. So far, we have no food. All we have planted to get food was washed away by the rains. We have been reduced to zero here in Chimanimani, says Dube Magoso. Emergency workers have described the flooding after Cyclone Idai as the region's most destructive in 20 years. Zimbabwe's government says it is having trouble keeping track of the death toll. It says the number is now over 100. It also cannot meet the demand for medicine, food, and other essentials. Visiting the area, July Moyo, Zimbabwe's local government minister, says the international community can assist in the areas of need. He added,
The commanders are telling me that they are retrieving people who are being buried everywhere. We understand some of them were swept away into Mozambique and will be checking to see what we can do to retrieve those. We are dropping medicine so that we don't have more people dying. We have moved most of the food that is in Mtare to forward places so that we can start moving along roads that are now passable.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa has declared Saturday and Sunday as days of mourning for all those who perished last week when the natural disaster hit here. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chimanimani, Zimbabwe.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa tackled the sensitive topic of the deaths of thousands in Matabeleland 30 years ago in a closed-door meeting with civil society activists in Bulawayo. The gathering was part of what state media calls the new government policy of engagement. Participants saw the gathering as a change from the government's recent accusations that civic action groups have a regime change agenda. For VOA, Adigondo has more from Bulawayo.
Representatives of more than 120 civic and religious groups operating under the umbrella title Matabeleland Collective met with President Emmerson Mnangagwa. The relationship between the state and civic society in Bulawayo has been marked by acrimony, rooted in the 1980s genocide in Matabeleland and Midlands during the early days of President Robert Mugabe's government. Mnangagwa replaced Mugabe as president and head of the ZANU-PF party in 2017. Jenny Williams is the leader of Women of Zimbabwe Arise, WOZA, and was at the Bulawayo State House for the meeting this week.
We have spent the last year engaging and trying to get the president to come and see us and hear our issues. This is a long-term thing we have been working on. Yes, at least 6 weeks ago, we then received an indication that the president was now looking to make a date to come and meet with us. We were then very pleased to be given the 21st of March, and we were very pleased to hear that we would set the agenda. We then had an incredible opportunity to engage with him. He has undertaken to help to decriminalize Gukurahundi. It's work in progress.
Williams says the meeting included a frank discussion on Gukurahundi, the name given to the genocide precipitated by the political fallout between Mugabe's ZANU-PF and ZAPU led by Joshua Nkomo. 20,000 people died in Mugabe's crackdown on the region. The period led to ethnic tensions between the largely Shona-speaking majority and Debele-speaking minority. Observers say that ethnic strain has infected social cohesion in the region and country. Cries for justice and compensation have largely been ignored until recently with the formation of the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission. While organizers say Mnangagwa's meeting with civic leaders in Bulawayo is a milestone event, other activists say too many groups were excluded. Max Nkandla of the Zimbabwe Liberators Peace Forum is among them. He says that though the Matabeleland Collective's meeting with Mnangagwa at State House was a noble idea in principle, it was marred by the absence of Matabeleland chiefs and other players.
They are not in that level to discuss the issue of Gukurahundi without any form of resolution. What we do understand is that there are only two chiefs and the political parties like MLF or MRP who are actually dealing with the issue of the Gukurahundi, because that was political.
The MRP, or Mtwakazi Republican Party, and MLF, the Mtwakazi Liberation Front, call for secession because of what they call the marginalization of ethnic Ndebeles. The Gukurahundi legacy remains highly emotive and divisive. One problem for many in the country is that Mnangagwa himself has been accused of being the architect of the genocide because he was the minister responsible for state security during the period. Mnangagwa's backers, however, say all blame lies with former President Mugabe. Thomas Stole, a political commentator, welcomes the engagement, although he sees it as mainly Mnangagwa's attempt to brand himself as a listening leader.
Given his predecessor's stance and attitude towards civic society that he saw as agents of regime change, civic society struggle for democratization, good governance, and human rights has been shared by progressive formations within society, such as some members of the opposition. And as a result of that, many a time such forces found themselves in the same trenches, united by similar causes, principles, and ideals. However, it shall be noted that while some civic society members became closer to some political formations as a result of the struggle fed to, the mainstream civic society remains non-partisan and impartial.
Participants at the closed-door meeting say they also discuss national healing, compensatory development, devolution, and inclusivity. President Mnangagwa said the meeting is the beginning of dialogue sessions he hopes to have in the country, and that he is committed to allowing free expression on Gukurahundi and eradicating a culture of fear. However, one civic leader, Zenzele Ndebele, was arrested on his way to the gathering after police found use tear gas canisters in his car at the Bulawayo State House. He has since been released after a magistrate dismissed the charge against him of possessing dangerous weapons. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigon.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. It was a weekend of Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Burundi qualified for the Africa Cup of Nations finals for the first time in their history on Saturday with a 1-1 draw at home to Gabon, who have been eliminated. Cedric Amissi scored in the 76th minute as Burundi, who only needed a draw to qualify, looked to have sealed their place at Egypt 2019. The result means Burundi finished second in Group C behind group leaders Mali, who have already qualified, with Gabon, the 2017 Nations Cup hosts, third. Burundi, who are 138th in the FIFA rankings, will join fellow East Africans, Uganda and Kenya, at the 2019 finals in Egypt. Tanzania are also still in contention for a place in Egypt ahead of their derby against Uganda Cranes in Dar es Salaam on Sunday. On Friday, Angola sealed their place at the finals with a 1-0 win away to Botswana in their final match of Group I. Burkina Faso's 1-0 win over the already qualified Mauritania was not enough for the Stallions to qualify for the finals. The results mean that Angola topped the group ahead of Mauritania thanks to a better head-to-head record, with both teams on 12 points. In Group A, Equatorial Guinea finished their campaign with a resounding 4-1 win over Sudan in a match between two sides already out of contention for the Nations Cup finals. Senegal and Madagascar, the other teams in Group A, have already qualified for the finals. In Group B, already eliminated Malawi held qualified Morocco to a goalless draw in their final Group B game. In the other game in the group on Saturday, Cameroon beat Comoros 3-0 to qualify. The Indomitable Lions, who won the last Nations Cup in 2017, needed at least a draw against Comoros to reach this year's finals after Cameroon were stripped of hosting right in November last year. The Gambia could only get a draw in Group D against group leaders Algeria on Friday, meaning that their qualification hopes are over. The Gambia needed a win and for the result to go their way in the Togo against Benin match on Sunday. On Sunday, Benin will qualify with a win or a draw in their clash with Togo, who can also qualify with a win. Nigeria ensured they will finish top of Group E with a 3-1 win over Seychelles, who had already been eliminated. The winner of Sunday's South Africa-Libya match will join the Super Eagles at the finals in Egypt. A draw will be enough for South Africa to qualify, while Libya only a win will see them progress. In Group J, Tunisia easily beat Eswatini 4-0. Tunisia have already qualified from the group, while Eswatini have already been eliminated. Federation of Uganda Football Association's FUFA has appointed Ghanaian Samuel Fabin Kwesi as the head coach for their national under-17 and under-20 teams for a period of 1 year. Kwesi's immediate task at hand will be to handle the Uganda under-17 Cubs at the 2019 Toto Africa Cup of Nations under-17 finals in Tanzania to start on April 14th. Uganda was drawn in Group A alongside host Tanzania, Nigeria and Angola. The semi-finalists will represent Africa in the Under-17 World Cup to be held in Brazil. Finally, in athletics, past Olympic champions Stephen Kiprotich of Uganda and Kenya's Ezekiel Kemboi are the latest star names added to the field of the Haspa Marathon Hamburg on April 28th. Kiprotich, the 2012 Olympic and 2013 World Marathon champion, will return to the northern German port city for the third time after finishing second in 2017 and fifth 1 year ago. The 29-year-old, who is the national record holder, clocked sub-2:08 performance in both of his Hamburg appearances. Kemboi, meanwhile, a two-time Olympic and four-time world champion in the 3,000 meters steeplechase, will be making his eagerly anticipated marathon debut. The fastest runner on the start list is Ayele Abushero, who clocked 2:04.23 in his marathon debut at the 2012 Dubai Marathon. The Ethiopian returns after finishing third last year. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. And you are hearing from A Pass with Didi Dada. Yemi Alade comes second, featuring Slim Keys and Brani with Yaji. Then follows Diamond Platinums featuring Khadija Kopa with Nasema Nawi. And then we end with Imbongeni Ngema with My Baby.
Like a doka, tell a girl me no see the waiter, so me have to give you the soda. Girl a move like a helicopter, but tambuza about the structure. Girl a duster on another chapter, in a life I never be an actor. You be da da da. Fuka producer, Nunza Nyanga piano. Shake me, shake me, a bum bum bum.
I no be SDG. Green wa BTS. Over that, me lock me ES. I want drop, I love busy weather. Kaki no be leather. Slim case, hear me, the brainy at the release.
Oh, yeah,
wait,
what's the matter? I drop the money, I drop the data. Send the answer. Drop the onions, drop the suya. Monkey, they walk. Babu, they show. Ghana girls go bum bum bum, shaking it, shaking your bum bum bum, liking your package, feeling the package, making the boys do no no no. Antiques you go down, go down, don't let me bend down. Like see you they sweep down, oh yeah, broad your shoulders, girl. Yachi, 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 the money they make me the baby.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The weather-related disaster that descended on Mozambique and two inland landlocked states, Zimbabwe and Malawi, has raised serious problems about preparedness to counter such calamity in the future. For over 1 week, Mozambique in particular has been battered first by floods and then by cyclones. This has resulted in loss of lives in the thousands, massive destructions, and people in grave danger. At a time when there was need for shelter and food, it was difficult to meet these needs because of the breakdown of infrastructure. International assistance were rushing in, but the environment was not suitable to provide the necessary humanitarian assistance. Fortunately for Mozambique, the Indian government was able to divert some of its battleships towards the Mozambique coast, and this Indian military has been enormously helpful in the rescue operation throughout this period. The South African military has also been very helpful. The United Nations humanitarian assistance community, the lead being taken by the World Food Programme, have been trying to meet the needs of the vulnerable population, but it has not been adequate. Of course, these governments, Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, have been doing their best, but they are in no way in a position to cope by themselves with this disaster. The question then is, what should be done for the future? Yes, many African countries have been developing a protection for humanitarian disasters, but these are not the type that are necessary for these forthcoming climate-related disasters around the African continent and also around the world. Just bear in mind that even in other countries, these preparedness is a political issue. Americans are familiar with the word Katrina, which was a disaster for the Bush administration. And only recently, the hurricane disaster in Puerto Rico presented great difficulties for the Trump administration. It is therefore time for the African Union to take the lead, with the assistance, of course, of regional economic communities in Africa, to prepare plans to meet such disasters. Africa will need international assistance, which will include the UN. But it will be helpful if serious plans are made within Africa itself to meet such a disaster. It is not enough to call on the UN when you have the disaster, as was done in Mozambique, when the UN humanitarian agencies were being called to send experts to do this and to do that. The countries themselves must do so. People have asked, what was the lessons learned in Mozambique about the disaster of 2000? According to reports, not much. But this is an opportunity where the issue of preparedness should be given serious consideration in the continent. Therefore, Africans should call on the African Union to begin this process and to ensure that in future, Africa will be able by itself, with international assistance, to cope with such disasters. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and engineer for today's Shao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, it is the wandering dog that finds the old bone. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.